going to now introduce Professor Roy McConkey, who has conducted a further piece from his original study, and I'm going to get Roy to talk to us about his latest piece now. Thank you. And again, I'll allow some minutes for questions on Roy's specific presentation, and then we'll have time for a general discussion.
Thanks, Hugh. Well, if some of you were at the RDS this time last year, this might seem like a repeat, but as BBC and RTE say, if it's so good the first time, it's worth seeing again. So forgive me this repetition, but there is a bit of additionality as well. I should acknowledge the people who have assisted in this work. Rachel Stevens was involved as project manager and set it up. Brendan Bunting is a specialist in mental health and also a statistician. Marie Wolfe is an advocate working with Empower All. And Edernie Garcia-Ariete from Trinity College is a specialist in qualitative research. Not shown there is Fiona Ferry, who's a health economist, and also Sharon Brady, who is a statistician also. We've been assisted by a loyal team of research assistants based in the Republic who did a lot of the data gathering for us. They stuck with us over 4 years, and we're delighted that we had that support. Well, as Hugh's already mentioned, there are certain drivers for this whole approach. It actually goes back to the mid-50s. Now, I wasn't that old in the mid-50s, but I do know from working in Ireland, organisations like St Michael's House and Parents and Friends Associations around the country broke the mould of what would have been largely institutional-based provision. So the whole advent of community services, we're on a path that really can be traced back historically, and that this is another iteration that we're seeing. So there's some comfort in that we've got the expertise, and yet we're still challenged with taking it a bit further. There's been self-advocacy and family advocacy saying we want better outcomes for ourselves and for our relatives. There's the whole aspect of the rights and equal opportunities that are now recognised in international legislation as well as national legislation that we cannot ignore. And in the UK system, you've got the right to a judicial review if you feel your rights or opportunities have been neglected. And that conflicted way of tackling the entitlement to rights is not the ideal one. It takes a lot of money out of the system. So if we can appreciate people's rights and opportunities and give them to them, rather than having to fight to get them, I think that's an advantage as well. And of course, already this morning, we've seen examples of the questions around the whole value for money. We look down from the north on you. I mean that in the nicest possible sense. We look down geographically and I'm impressed by the amount of money that you have invested in intellectual disability services. It must be about 50% more than what we would have invested per capita in the north of Ireland. So you have been very generous. You may not feel that, but comparatively speaking on these islands, you have been very generous in the amount of money you've put into intellectual disability services. But you're right to ask, are we getting value for money? Well, it's been a great privilege for us to be part of this longitudinal study. Rarely does that come along. And also to be part of a study that embraces people with intellectual disability. There's 12 different intellectual disability services were involved in this particular evaluation, involving 115 beneficiaries. Now, they were all self-selected services. They went through a process of bidding to Genio to get a grant to help them to do that. So you have to bear that in mind. This is a self-selected population. And then within that, and in their grant, they put in the names of people that they wanted to support to move into more personalised arrangements. So as Richard answered the last question, there is yet another process of selection going on there. So you do have to bear that in mind, that these are not typical organisations, but they are illustrative organisations, and that's really critical. Now, in addition, what was unique is that we had access to mental health services as well. 8 different services involved, totaling 64 people in all at the outset. People who might have been living in congregated ward-like settings or in hostel accommodation, but who the process of Genio's funding and support, they had moved into more personalised arrangements. In addition, there were 3 physical disability services involving 17 beneficiaries initially. And these services were both a combination of NGO and HSC provider services. They were variable sizes. Some of these were very large, well-funded, long-established organisations. Some were relatively small scale. And in terms of the length of time people had been receiving a service, that also could vary. Sometimes people had only been within the service for a short period, others had been there for many years. Longitudinal in that we began data gathering in October 2011, time one. Time two was about 6 months later in 2012. Time three then was almost another 9 months on. And then laterally we had additional funding that AP made available to Genio to do a further data uplift. So this again is makes this study particularly unique in that we have this longitudinal dimension. Now, the people at times one were living in three different types of arrangements. They were in congregated settings, and that was what the project was essentially intended to do. But we only became involved 1 year into the program. So effectively, some people had already moved to personalized arrangements before we began the evaluation. And then there were a group of people living with family carers, and the intention was that they too might also move to other forms of accommodation outside of the family. So by times four, sadly, there were still some people continuing to live in congregated settings. The plan had not materialized for them. Some of the reasons were given earlier, difficulty of accessing housing. Now, that isn't to say that they hadn't been involved in preparing and getting geared up for moving, but that hadn't happened. Some people had moved to group homes, and group homes were predominantly people with intellectual disability, and others had moved to personalized arrangements. And those personalized arrangements, a predominance of people with mental health problems. By times four, the people that were in personalized continued to be in personalized. We probably had some dropout, we did certainly have some dropout by times four of people from that group, because by the time we came to the fourth time and said to them, and what's life for you like now? They said, have you not heard me three times previously? I've told you. People living with family carers, some did, but some also had moved to some of the various settings that are there. Here's the numbers of people that were involved. The largest group, as you can see at times one, were in congregated settings, nearly 100 people, small numbers in those other arrangements. By times two, the congregated numbers had dropped and people had moved predominantly to group homes, as you can see, but some also to personalised arrangements. People staying with the family, only a small increase. Not a great deal of change happened between times two and times three. And by times four, though, you had the continuing decline in the congregated and you had the uplift of people with personalised and people in group homes. Now, what this graph doesn't account for are people who didn't take part in our times four data analysis. So the actual numbers would have been bigger than that. But this is to give you an illustration of the, if you like, the statistical power that is available to us when we make the intergroup comparisons. Now, essentially, the outcomes focus was the dominant driver in this piece of research. What are the outcomes like for people in those different arrangements? And we did take, if you like, a quality of life framework to help guide us as to what those outcomes might be. So we were looking at living arrangements, the support people had, the relationships they had, what valued roles they had in community, healthy lifestyles, and so on. And we identified a number of potential indicators that would help identify what those might be. We put those in the form of structured questions, or we used rating scales, or we did one-on-one interviews with people. Wherever possible, we used as informants the people themselves. That included people with intellectual disabilities, of course, as well as people with mental health and physical disabilities. If people wanted a supporter with them to help them recall or to help answer the questions, that was also permissible. But as far as possible, we're trying to reflect what the people's own lived experiences were. So when we came to look at the wealth of data that we had gathered, not just at one time point, but over subsequent time points, we were able then to use this, a statistical approach that says, if your theory of change is that people who live in personalized arrangements will have a better quality of life than people who are in other congregated type settings, then a statistical procedure called latent class analysis helps you identify what are the variables that best discriminate those groups, because that's the logic of what you're trying to do. And part of this evaluation is really to say, does a change in support arrangements predicate a change in quality of life? Now, in the different domains that are listed there, there were indeed variables that could identify as being significant discriminators for people. So, for example, having a key to your house or having being free to come and go as you please were two big indicators of personalised accommodation. In terms of personalised support, it was choosing your own support staff and so on. Interestingly, when I looked at the recent Eurofund quality of life survey that's done all over Europe with all European citizens, you get echoes of these same indicators in terms of what makes a quality of life for Europeans today, like having a job, having friends visiting you, having neighbours who you provide help to. And we hadn't actually used that data as a source, but it does provide another comparator now in terms of how your population of people with intellectual disabilities, say, or with mental health problems, how their quality of life compares with the latest Irish data, which was in 2012, and that's available on the Eurofund web pages. But when you look at it in terms of the samples that we're dealing with, and here I'm using times 1, 3, and 4 to indicate it, the percentage of people who responded as having a key to their house, if you lived in congregated settings, was actually very low. In terms of group people who moved from congregated to group homes, you can see that it rises particularly as we get to times 4, but still relatively small. If, however, you move from congregated to personalised arrangements, then you get a much steeper increase. If you were already in personalised arrangements, your scores were very high. And if you were living with families, likewise, but somewhat lower. So again, that just illustrates what I was saying about the discrimination between personalised and non-personalised arrangements. Here's another example of the percentage of friends who come from a meal. If you're in congregated settings, that's fairly unlikely to happen. Likewise, if you're in a group home, although that increase is significant for people, because now that we have got this longitudinal data, we can do analysis that actually determines the significance of change, and that significance is there for people in group homes, and also for people who move to personalised arrangements. You see a higher level of increase, also a very significant increase. Those that are in personalised arrangements, that difference, that increase isn't significant statistically, but on the same rate as people in personalised. And people who are in family settings, also an increase, a significant increase, but not to the same extent as some of the others. Now, I could bore you with showing you 16 other slides that cover all those different points, but I think you can start to see a pattern emerging. Basically, there is a continuing consolidation, if you like, of people's quality of life over time, this gradual increase that's there. And also that you can see how the differences between moving to a group home and moving to personalised arrangements, which does tend to come out in our data as well, that is not as good a move. It may score reasonably well in certain indicators, but it is not as good a move as people who move to personalised arrangements. So there's a value for money question around group homes as well as personalised arrangements. Now, one of the things that was rather maybe, although it's clearly different here in terms of this indicator of community activity, this is participation in sports, fitness, and so on. That was the indicator that came out best among many others. But you can see there that little difference over time, but the main difference is around, again, people in group homes actually being less community involved than even people, in this instance, in congregated settings. You may think that's rather odd, but I suspect what's happened there is that people are taking their leisure and recreation within the congregated environment of the campus setting with its own swimming pools, sports playing fields and whatever. And sadly, they lose that when they go into group homes, but not so much when it goes into personalised arrangements. So on those different indicators, and we can do a lot more statistical analysis still to actually confirm some of the factors. Well, is this related to the level of functioning of people rather than to the type of accommodation they're in? No, that doesn't seem to be the case. Is it related to the gender of the people? Are males more advantaged than females or vice versa? No, that doesn't seem to come out either. So a lot of the most powerful predictor in any of the regression analysis we've done to date has been in terms of the accommodation factor. That swamps all the other factors that may well contribute, and indeed they do contribute, to the overall ratings, but they're not necessarily the most potent predictor. The different informants we used, as I said, were people supported by and large. We have information from the key workers, and that's been very helpful at trying to track the way in which their role has changed and the way in which they work with individuals. We've also talked to relatives and heard firsthand about some of the uncertainties and maybe even opposition that relatives showed initially. But once their relatives had moved, they were then very supportive. And indeed, my experience in Scotland and elsewhere, where I've been involved in things like resettlement programmes, is that often the best people to speak to other relatives are relatives rather than professionals, because they suspect we've got another agenda. But the relatives who have had the experience of, if you like, conversion, are the people who are really good evangelists when it comes to selling new models of service delivery. But we were also keen to hear the views of managers and trying to understand better, well, why did you apply for this money in the first place? Why did you go to all the bother of taking on all this extra work, stepping outside the box, if you like, into a zone of uncertainty? So we interviewed people, we had them in focus groups. We had some 18 managers out of the 22 projects that had been involved in the service evaluation. And I guess what came out of those discussions was seeing the model or the analogy of an engine needing to drive change, the change that they had been promoting in terms of personalisation and group homes. And at the heart of this engine, if you like, the dominant theme was around organisation and organisational culture. And that was echoed, for example, as this person said, and as Fiona's already extracted in her presentation, leadership was crucial, right from the board of directors, recognising that we were going in a different direction to the one we had done. And some of these board of directors, remember, were the people that set up that service in the very first place. They invested a hell of a lot of time, energy in creating what they thought was the service of the future for their sons and daughters, and it would last forever. There, now we're asking them to trust us that there's another way of doing things. Also, we had leadership was crucial from the managers, and also recognising the leadership capacity in individuals right across the organisation. Very different to a management approach, where managers are often supervising the people and directing the people. To be able to trust a frontline worker or a volunteer and say, you probably can do this job without me managing you, is a big ask in terms of a culture shift and organisations. They also spoke highly of Genio and how important that was. They described themselves as being part of a loose alliance of organisations who were all interested in doing this and who were sharing examples with each other of things they had done. It was a kind of learning community. So Genio brought knowledge and skills, but also a sense of solidarity and support, which can be fairly critical if you're an autonomous organisation and your immediate neighbours in the area are implicitly quite critical of what you're doing, and you may well be seen as rocking the boat and creating problems for us. Stepping out of line isn't always easy, but it's easier to do it in the context of some sort of an alliance. Another big theme that emerged was the need to think about new roles for support staff. The other major factor for us was that our clients didn't see the people who were supporting them as staff. They had no previous history with them, the people that were supporting them in this new personalised arrangements. People saw our Genio support workers as something different, something for them. So they took ownership of them. And once they took ownership of it, they flew with it. So the person telling the staff what to do, rather than the staff telling the person what to do, albeit with the best interest of the person at heart, was a very big culture shift in terms of staff thought. And there are many echoes of how the advantages of recruiting people who were new to disability services was a more powerful instigator of change than redeploying staff who came with, if you like, the baggage of how services traditionally functioned, and that could get in the way of real change. The fourth biggie in terms of the themes was in terms of service users themselves and them having to create a new identity for themselves. Donal was explaining there the medical model of disability, but one of the aspects of that I think we ignore is the impact it has on the identity of the person. you are disabled. How do I know you're disabled? Because you go to see psychologists, you go to see therapists, you go to see doctors, you're in health systems. People treat you as a patient rather than treating you as a person. So what's really going on here was when we, as this person says, we thought our job was to get people their own homes and help them in their homes. But in fact, the job became helping people discover who they are, how they make choices, and what they actually wanted. You know, that old term learned helplessness that was used traditionally over the years just rings so true here, that in many ways people are happy with the lot they're given. So when you give them new opportunities, you have to inculcate that into them. And the final big theme that came out of this driver for change was that of relatives. The mindset of families, said one informant, is that they actually believe that their sons and daughters are children. They don't fall into the category of adults. And that's our fault as service providers, to have let that happen and not to have challenged that. So this process of personalization starts almost from birth and goes right through schooling. And if anything that we have learned from this whole process is it's rather late to leave it to when they're school leavers or to when they're people moving into their own accommodation as adults. That ambition for your child to have an ordinary life and to have the same aspirations to an ordinary life needs to be sown in what you might call early intervention services in nursery schools and in primary schools. And I'm not so sure that we've actually cracked that one at all. Now, there were four other themes that people mentioned as being particularly critical in making change happen. The importance of communication. The project has made the wider organisation see that the closure of the institution is a reality, and that community integration with a valued, meaningful life chosen by the clients can be a reality. And that's Fiona's point about having a model project within your service that people that you know actually then say, well, this is the change I've experienced. This is how we did it. This is how we brought it about. So that communicating of insight is a critical element. There were three other subsidiary themes, which I'll not elaborate, but I think it's significant that these were less critical in terms of what helped change. Finances was one, housing, you've heard mention of, and community contacts, the availability of them were all critical in helping take this process forward. And an article describing all of that model have been published recently in the IPA Journal Administration, if you want more detail on that. So what does that say about personalisation? Well, I guess one of the big issues is around how do you refer to people when you're in these new models of service delivery? It may seem a very small point, but what is the appropriate terminology of the future to be? Are they people we support? Do we drop clients? Do we drop service users? Because they're not using services in the traditional sense. And what is the service anyway? How do you refer to yourself? What terms do you use for that? The whole importance of identity formation, and that's from the person with a disability to the member of staff, to the managers, to the board of directors. Who are we? Who are we in this new model? What is the identity that we're ascribing and assuming in part of that? Big issues around national implementation. I think you're doing fantastically well in Ireland in actually trying and reflecting on your learning experiences. There's no other place in these islands that's committing itself to doing the sort of work you're doing at the moment. So that certainly is in your favour big time. And it may well be that you will achieve national implementation in a way that we've never been able to do, for example, in the UK model, where we have terrific variation in the way services get delivered. But remember, these were self-selected, self-directed projects, and I guess the majority of services are still unaffected by all of that. And it does raise the issue then, can people hold their own budgets and buy their own services? That's a model that's been tried in various European, North American countries and in Australia. The evidence seems largely well disposed to it, but it does create a hell of a problem for government in how you account for those services. But if those are the issues for the future, let's remember the achievements we have in the present, that this can become a reality. With effort, with hard work, but through partnerships. And I've been delighted that I've been able to join that partnership in some small scale way. If you need any more information, there's also the previous report, which might be available to people as they leave, or it's on the website. We'll be writing an updated report, which gives you times for happy reading.